me tell you of the days of high adventure.
Hey, I'm Mike.
And I'm Kevin.
And this is 6 Degrees of Schwarzenegger, the podcast where we take a long, hard look at some of your favorite action movies from the era of Arnold.
Schwarzenegger is the icon of the genre, and we're taking a deep dive into some of these 80s and 90s cult action movies and breaking them all the way down. Welcome back, everybody. This is Kevin. I'm back with Mike.
Howdy ho.
And we're going to be talking about a movie that's near and dear to both of our hearts, 1982's Beastmaster. We're also joined by a special guest, college roommate of mine from Georgia State, John Arnold.
Hi.
We're very excited. We're very excited to welcome John in from out of town, a Beastmaster aficionado.
I don't know about that, but greetings from Houston nonetheless.
John, do you remember the first time you saw the movie?
I have vivid recollections of just about every Sunday coming home from church, my sister making lunch, and us watching Beastmaster every week.
I feel like it was on TBS every week. Yeah. Like it was reliably, it would be on once a weekend at least.
Yeah, I was watching, I was looking at some notes and it was, somebody said, cause it was on HBO a lot and he was saying, has Beastmaster on or something like that. That's what HBO stands for. And I'm pretty sure that's where I saw Beastmaster as a kid.
I didn't grow up with HBO, so I was watching that TV edit all along. So seeing it now opened my eyes a little bit.
They said that Beastmaster was the second most frequent showing on TBS and TNT behind Gone with the Wind.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a true fact?
That's a true fact.
That's
look that
awesome.
One up. That's Googleable. Look that one up.
Cool. Yeah, this movie, I probably hadn't watched it in 15 years at least, maybe 20 years. And when I was watching it, it all came flooding back.
Yeah. I agree. I don't even remember the last time I saw it, but you're right. As soon as I started watching it, it's like, oh yeah, I remember all of this.
I mean, anytime back in the day, if I was flipping through the channels and it was on, I would stop and watch to the end. Yeah,
definitely.
Really?
I think so. Yeah. I loved it. I was, John and I are a bit younger than you. Like I'd be 10 years old. I'd get probably my He-Man toys out and I'd just sit and watch it the rest of the way and play with my toys.
I don't know if I could say I love this movie, but I do remember watching it like many, many times. And that's the thing that sticks out to me. I just know I saw it all the time. I guess, and we're going to get to it. The one thing that sticks out to me is the bird people, but just because that's such a cool scene.
They're creepy.
Yeah.
But all right, let's get to the meat here. I guess we should handle just like a little bit before. This movie is written and directed by a guy named Don Coscarelli.
Mm-hmm.
He had done a movie called Phantasm.
One of my favorite horror films.
I've never seen it, but I heard it was awesome. And then he did Bubba Hotep as well.
Never seen that.
I could never really vibe on it, but I know a lot of people like really loved that. There was probably I did the research. There's probably 15 or so barbarian movies that came out around the same era, like early 80s to late 80s.
Big sword and sorcery time.
Yeah, it was and He-Man, of course, was big on TV.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
It was just like a heyday for dudes running around in loincloths with swords and stuff. But I give Conan, I feel like Conan was like the flagship movie, right?
And this is the one that came, and this movie came out the same year, correct?
Like just a couple months after.
After, okay.
They were probably in a race, we can get this out when Conan's still a movie that people are talking about.
Not according to the DVD commentary. Coscarelli denies that he knew anything about Conan.
I mean, it's a
lie.
Yeah,
absolutely. It has to be a lie.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
I mean, I know they didn't have social media like we do now, but I feel like Hollywood back then was a lot smaller. Script was floating around. And this does have the feel of a knockoff film. Although it's based on a book, and I forget the lady's name, but...
John knows.
Andre Norton.
Yeah.
Last Navajo.
I mean, that's a woman, though, right?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was. So the name is Andre Norton, but I know it's a female that wrote it.
Okay. Okay.
So I guess that's her pen name.
And it was like a person who, a warrior who talked to animals.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. It's like a violent
the same
Dr.
kind of
Doolittle.
Thing, like Puma, Eagle, Bear, Wolf kind of.
A rated R Dr. Doolittle.
With a lot more like ass cheeks.
Exactly. A lot.
I mean, the opening credits on this thing are terrible. It's like all these still frames of animals. It's just production stills, basically, I feel like. Just the same hawk or eagle, whatever, over and over again from different angles, and the big cat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just, you know, the music was great, though. I think we can agree. I like the music.
Excellent.
Really? I don't know.
It
doesn't stick out to me. Yeah.
I just remember thinking, no, the music's outdoing what we're seeing.
It's very cinematic.
The guy's name is Lee Holdridge, and the only other thing he ever really did was the theme song from Moonlighting, for which he won like a daytime Emmy.
Very nice.
I don't think I ever watched Moonlighting either, or would know this.
But the thing is, so the guy wasn't doing just like schlock B movie type, like in his garage. Yeah,
he had like a career.
Gotcha. real quick note. So this film was made in California. Doesn't it look like it was made in Italy or Spain? Like they just like took the whole crew over there for real cheap because they could just film over there.
What I read said like California and Nevada.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the Mojave Desert or Death Valley area.
Yeah, but doesn't that like boost the production cost?
It looked awesome. I mean, I thought the landscape looked nice. The rock formations and all that. We also, I think, all noticed that this movie was shot by John Alcott, was the cinematographer, who's like a big deal.
Yeah.
He was like Kubrick's guy.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
This dude shot, before this, he shot Clockwork Orange, Barry Lyndon, and The Shining.
So you basically...
And then he went into to the Beastmaster.
So you're saying Beastmaster pay for like that two-door garage in his house, or he wanted to like
another car.
He kind of
never worked for Kubrick again.
There had to have been some
They had a falling out
event.
Another theory... Kubrick saw Beastmaster and said, "You'll never work for me again."
But you have to think that when people make movies, especially like a movie like Beastmaster, they go into it with all good intentions, right?
Oh, of course.
They're like, "I'm making a quality film." Especially Don Coscarella, like he seems like the kind of guy that's like really enjoys making movies.
Did he on the commentary? Was he like? Did he take the movie seriously after the fact?
Yeah, it seemed by and large like. Unironic, like you hear some like 80s directors and stuff talking about films and it's like kind of tongue-in-cheek, they didn't really care about it, but in his defense it seems like he was in earnest,
like he was, I'm just trying to get my foot in the door, right. So I'm making this movie for Roger Corman right quick before I get my own movie.
I guess this is where the plot of the movie kicks in, right? We got these like robed figures walking through some village. It all is like very desert looking, walk into a like a big ass pyramid.
Yeah. Mayan.
Pyramid. It did have that Mayan look, like tiered stair steps.
Kind of reminded me of like the Three Wise Men.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, considering what they
in
were
the
going,
setting. Yeah. The, like hut, like sort of like dried mud huts. And
yeah.
Stuff like
yeah.
That.
And then once you see where they're going to talk about a child. And it's, you know, it kind of has that biblical feel to it.
But inside, we got these three witches that are like gyrating over a cauldron.
Yes. Do you know who one of those witches?
I looked them all up and they were all hot.
Well, one of them is Janet Jones.
Okay, what was she known for?
Isn't that Wayne Gretzky's wife?
I don't know.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I looked them up and they were all like, of course, they were
hot
in real life. They made them up to look hideous. Like these, their chicks were like the original Butterfaces. Like they were banging, but their faces were like old lady faces kind of.
No. Like the sexy witches from Macbeth. Like it doesn't work.
So yeah, Janet Jones was witch woman number three. Yeah, I don't know if that
means I never knew could tell which one was supposed to be which.
Yeah, I don't know which
I looked them all up and they were all like, of course, they were like the hottest chicks available at the time.
So I thought that was kind of interesting that like there are like real people in this movie. And I know that sounds weird, but there were like
real people.
Legit like named people.
No, I know
like,
what you mean. Like they went on, they had families.
Yeah,
like,
they had careers.
People who cared about them.
It's like, that's a real person.
They're a real person, not just like a disposable.
Exactly.
And this was the first and only thing they ever did.
Yeah. Well, Janet Jones did marry Wayne Gretzky, so.
I wonder if that was like, so one of the witches gave us like a lot of ass crack on that. The skirt shifted to the side. I wonder if that could have been Janet.
And I saw this on YouTube and it said, hey, everybody out there, it's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube for free.
And it shows everything. So,
if that means anything to you. If you want to press pause and watch the movie and then come back.
Butt creak at 2 minutes and 32 seconds.
And They got their leader is a guy called Mayax, played by Rip Torn, with a fake nose on, right?
Oh, yeah. Really bad fake nose.
Okay. I was like, did he have a nose job later and that was real? But okay, it was definitely fake. So it's like a bird-like nose.
Yeah, he insisted on that. I think he brought that from home. It's part of his personal collection.
It really kind of makes no sense why he has that nose.
No, it's distracting.
Like, I wonder if, like, because Rip Torn, to me, seems like the kind of actor that was, like, drinking Jack Daniels during takes. So I wonder if he was,
like an old-school guy? Yeah, like just, a tough guy.
Like, hitting, like, doing cigars and everything. So I'm wondering if he was, like, you know, had a busted nose or something like that.
Makes sense. So he grew up in Texas and was a rancher and said that he got into movies and acting because he wanted to buy his own ranch.
Okay.
So rough and tumble Texan, and then as we see later in the movie, he's got some physical strength, even though those are children.
But he's been pressing little toddlers.
Arnold would be proud.
So these witches, they prophesize that the unborn son of the king, King Zedd, is going to kill Mayax. So Mayax plans to kill the son first, I guess. And this is one of those lines that sticks in all of our heads, I think, where it's like, he will die.
He will die tonight.
It's just all like over the top. Yeah. But I love it. At this very moment, right when they're talking about we got to kill Zed's son, that's when Zed walks in with all his like his little soldiers, and he's got his top lieutenant there, which is John Amos.
Yeah, John Amos plays Seth, the palace guard, and he's in full guard or his outfit and everything like that, which kind of sets up when you see him later on in the film.
So you know John Amos from Good Times, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, other stuff.
He was the bad guy in Die Hard 2.
Yeah, he was.
Or one of the bad guys in there. So he's got like some action movie pedigree. He's great in here. I mean, he looked great in like the get up and all that, the loincloth.
Yeah, for me, it was like I knew John Amos from mostly Good Times at that point, and it was just good to see him in like an action film, because you know, there weren't, you didn't see a lot of black actors in action films back then. So for me to see that was great,
and he got to be like the strong, like the tough guy,
the good tough guy. Absolutely.
So then Zed tells Mayax, you're out of here, basically we're kicking you out of the village, and Mayax he lays out the whole plan, like, I'm gonna kill your son.
Well, so we talked about this, like, Mayax lays out the plan of killing his son, and then Zed's like, you gotta go. Like, who's gonna tell me you're about to kill my kid? And like, you know what? You leave the room. Like, you're go to sit in the corner. You're punished.
You're bad.
Yeah.
It's like just dumb old Zed. Exactly. It's like that's just not my style.
But I think Mayax does a really good job of showing like the dedication of his following by having his two guards side him. Like
ritual suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's creepy.
Yeah.
Like that's one of the more effective things in the movie, is just because it's creepy.
Well, the looks on all of their faces, like the little back and forth looks, and then Mayax's sort of self-satisfied little smile after they've done
it. He looks real proud.
He's super Jones. He's like, yeah. Nice.
Which is similar to in Conan.
Yeah, I was just
when James Earl Jones has one of the slaves just jump off that cliff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whatever, Zed. He's like, all right, take him prisoner.
Yeah.
Like, that's just not, I guess that's not how Zed handles conflict. He's just like,
he just lets him go.
We're going to walk you out of here and don't ever come back.
So, like, it's not like he stole his book bag or anything like that. He's like, he literally said, I'm going to kill your kid. You're not your kid, your unborn kid. Like, you can't just let that dude go, man.
So I love after this, we cut to one of the witches is creeping into Zed's tent. So Zed basically, and I don't even know how Zed was back in the tent in bed already at this time when they're escorting Max out on a horseback or whatever, but he's just there, no guards around, open air tent.
I think that you kind of have to preface this part is the same with the rest of the movie, and that is that as far as time is concerned, that a suspension of disbelief maybe is necessary. Okay. Like, maybe hours have passed.
Yeah,
that for me, it doesn't make any sense.
If some dude with a cult-like following is like, I'm going to kill your son tonight, I just can't see going back home and going to sleep. Like, no guard. Have some Z's.
Honey, it's been a rough day. Can you believe what Mayax told me?
Can you not, like,
said he was going to kill my kids. All right, good night. Good night.
He was sound asleep.
Well, that one witch, yeah, he was asleep, but the witch, she didn't just sneak into his room. She snuck in with an ox, not a cow, not a goat, a friggin' ox.
Like, the smell alone should have woken them up.
I mean, I'm surprised it didn't have like one of those ox bells on it, like ding, 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 and like they were just like out. And she's pregnant at this point, so you know she's got like morning sickness or like
it's not like creeping around corners by yourself.
Yeah,
you're dragging like 700, 800 pound of beef behind you.
So this is kind of badass because I like this moment where the witch has some sort of potion that she pours across the throats of the two of them that's like glowing like bright blue, I think. And it like pins them down sort of in some kind of way, like immobilizes them, which was a cool effect. And then she does some sort of witch type spell and transports the baby from the mother's belly into the ox.
Yeah.
Which I'm not really sure
why
it needed to be done in this way rather than just killed the baby right then and there, especially if you're like, this baby's gonna kill Mayax.
Yeah.
It seems like Mayax's top priority should just be, we gotta kill this baby by any means necessary, not some big ritual.
So like I said earlier, I felt this movie was about 15 minutes too long.
That's just a moment where they could have killed the baby Beastmaster right then and just been roll credits. Exactly.
And yeah. Credits.
The movie should have been called something else then.
It's true. It's a cool, effective moment for me when they transport like the baby into the ox's belly, because it's like the ox's belly is swelling up, and I don't really know how they did that, but it was a pretty cool effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how they did it either. I remember thinking that's really cool because they have like a fake stomach on the ox and just kind of blew it up with like a bladder or something like that?
It's got to be something cool.
Yeah, I don't know how they did that.
And then this witch, when she just vanishes, amazing cackle. There's some quality cackling in this movie.
I'll see if I can find that.
There's like half a dozen amazing just witch cackles in this.
Did they practice those cackles?
I don't know. They brought in a professional cackler for sure.
Okay, so the witch is out in the forest basically performing like this ritual in front of like this giant blue flame, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But she cuts the baby out of the ox. And then she's performing this ritual where she, I don't know, she brands the kid on the hand with some kind of a symbol.
It was like
the mark of R.
The mark of R.
The god.
that was when Mayax outlined the plan. Brand the baby, cut from the mother, sacrifice.
Right, like that's how it had to be done, I guess.
That's the sequence.
But they never say, like, what's the point of branding the kid if you're just going
to
kill it?
I guess it was sacrifice to the god. But if all your plan is to keep this kid from one day killing me, you definitely didn't have to do
that. Again, like I said, 15 minutes could have easily have been cut out of this. But I guess they had to have a way to recognize that he was the firstborn later in the film. So.
Right, right.
But just by chance, like this person out of nowhere comes along and he kind of sees what's going on from behind. He's, you know, creeping up on the lady. And he sees her raise up a knife.
Right, and he hears a baby crying.
Is that what
he can tell? The baby, like that something bad.
So he hears the branding. Hears a baby scream when the witch brands. Like,
this isn't right. So he takes out. I think it's called a glaive. If you've seen Krull, it's a lot like the glaive in Krull. But he throws it and he hits the lady in the back, right? Basically not killing her because I think she disappears.
Yeah, she like we walks up on the body, and then when he pulls the thing out, like the robes just collapse like Jedi style.
She Obi-Wan's.
Yeah.
Yeah, but doesn't she come back and like throw him into the fire?
She appears again behind him and whatever. They fight a little bit and he stabs her with his sword.
Yeah.
And that seems to finally kill her.
Yeah.
But she falls into the fire and goes up like right in a puff of smoke or something.
Yeah, she's combustible.
That must have been witchy woman number
and
one.
She let out a great cackle.
But so long story short, this guy comes along.
Very long story.
Yeah, this guy comes along and he basically saves the kid, which, you know, kind of cool because it's following along with this prophecy of the baby that's going to come back and kill Mayax. So all these things are kind of falling in line, even from that young age.
This happens in so many movies where it's like a prophecy of what's going to happen, and then by trying to prevent the prophecy from happening, you actually make sure it does happen.
Yeah.
That's like always.
So we skip ahead a couple of years, and now the kid is being trained by his new adopted father.
Right.
And they're sword fight training. And then his dad pulls out the
thing.
Yeah. So his dad pulls out the He's like, hey, check out this really cool thing.
And in the movie, they call it a caber.
A caber,
but
yeah.
But it's also...
It's called a glaive, like the official name.
It's like a real life, like a weapon that people really use.
It's like the glaive in Kroll that he mentioned. It's like, it's basically the boomerang style weapon of choice in the 1980s.
It's a sharp, it's a bladed weapon that'll come back to you.
It feels like a Celtic throwing star, you know, like that's the kind of feeling I get, but it's also like a boomerang. I don't see how it comes back. Cause it's like steel.
And then how you catch it without hurting yourself.
Cutting your hand.
Well, Mad Max, right?
In Mad Max, he had a special glove.
He comes back and he cuts off his dude's finger.
Feral kid.
He throws it
at a guy's head. He's like, here, watch this.
He takes the little rag off the top of his head, like his turban.
And the guy wasn't even mad.
He was like, a little mad.
He was like, you asshole or something like that. I was like, dude, you threw a freaking knife in my head, man.
And they think that's the funniest shit that's ever happened.
Cracking
no one's laughed hard.
They are laughing for 30 seconds at least.
They're having a good old time by almost killing somebody.
But when the boy, who I think for the sake of the podcast, we should just call Beastmaster so we don't get confused.
Okay.
Like about his name. He's Beastmaster.
Yeah, well, Dar.
It's Dar, but
they don't call him Beastmaster that much.
They only get called Beastmaster once.
A couple times,
I like saying Beastmaster.
Well, you do, Kevin.
Even despite Mark Singer's I'm Dar.
Yeah.
You said that really well.
He is a swaggering dog.
But this is where we kind of first see Dar's animal control. And I have no idea if like he's had this before. This is the first time they show it to us, you know, like he could have been sitting around the village and like he's communicating with his dog or something like that. Like,
I get the feeling this is the first time. It seemed like a surprise even to the young boy.
But the fact that he even knew to do that, you don't think he was like messing around with ants when he was like a 2-year-old? Just like to see if I could do the ants to do their own thing. And then when he was a little older, he could control snakes. And now that
he sensed that some sort of monster was in the brush or whatever, right?
Yeah.
Like, so maybe that was what the thing is. I can tell something bad's about to happen.
And they really do play it up like it was a monster. Like, I was kind of surprised that a bear jumped out. And
kind of a busted old bear.
Well, it was a huge bear. Like,
it was, but I feel like it was probably a retired circus bear.
Yeah, I guess.
Apparently, Bill Jane, who is the name of the young actor who you'll see in a lot of other 80s movies and stuff, he was not supposed to be on the set with that bear, especially after it had apparently gotten into it with, like, a handler or something like that. And so they had to substitute like a short actor with a wig because they couldn't be on set at the same time because of regulations.
The bear was still like a bad boy. Any bear can do damage.
That seems so reckless to put like an 11-year-old kid on set with a like 8-foot.
And that was like his first scene. Yeah,
it was his only scene.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I guess it was. Yeah. So the bear ends up killing that one guy.
And
his dad gives him this big long speech about. So if you guys can explain this to me, I please do. Like his dad gives him a big long speech about, look, you have these special powers. You shouldn't let anybody know that you have these powers because of X, Y, and Z. But you see that a lot, like it's Superman, and famously is like, don't let anybody know that you have all these superpowers. Why do you think the fathers are always telling their super kids not to?
Well, what you were just saying a second ago about him maybe having practiced his gift or whatever before, it kind of equates to the X-Men. The gift doesn't manifest itself until like puberty or whatever, and then all of a sudden they're aware of it. And then maybe if this is a superstitious culture, which it seems likely it was, especially since the religious fanatics are in charge of it, then having a bestial power like that would not be...
It would freak people out.
Yeah, it would freak people out.
So
I could see that, but also, couldn't he be like controlling all the oxes or whatever in the village and like they're just out there plowing the fields themselves? Like, he could have been like, he could have saved, like he could have made this village very, whatever, profitable.
Again, to Mike's point, this movie could have been 15 minutes shorter if Beastmaster could communicate with horses, which he apparently cannot.
I never Superman, I get, because he's like an alien and like nobody else on the supposedly nobody else on the planet has like these superpowers, but in this world you have witches and warlocks, and I mean
that's true.
You might even have a dragon or something like that. Like you just have all these mystical things, and so for somebody to talk to animals, that to me seems kind of like not that big a deal. Like, I feel like every village has somebody that talks to animals. So I just thought it was interesting that
I want that on a shirt.
Like the local shaman is like, yeah, you know, exactly. Go talk to the animals. So
basically it's a plot device, but Dad tells him, don't tell anyone about your secret, your animal secret. And the brand that's on your hand will be your guide for the future.
Yeah, that seems like his dad knew a lot. You know? So a lot of information Dad was giving out. A lot of exposition from Dad.
So we jump forward by probably another 20 years.
Yeah, so Dar's all grown up. Now he's
a blonde guy now.
Now he's Mark Singer. Oh, was he? He's, the little kid was...
He was dark brown. Brunette,
yeah.
He
was. He's like a mousy brown.
Yeah, he became blonde now.
Oh, okay. I didn't even really notice that. But so we're first introduced to Mark Singer as Dar, or the Beastmaster.
The Beastmaster. Title character. He had a very Luke Skywalker vibe to him, didn't he?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Like he's the farm boy, whatever.
This movie is at this point kind of following along with Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah.
Like, because this next scene,
it's like a peaceful village.
Yeah, they're just attacked by just kind of living life,
ruthless bad guys.
Yeah, and Dar has like this moment. And this is why you know that Dad's about to die, because Dar is walking out the village. I think he's like, yeah, doesn't he stop?
Father,
they just like sort of do some sort of hand gesture at each other.
He turns around and just says, "Father," which I took to mean like maybe that was a premonition. Maybe he felt like he wasn't. I needed to tell. YDF, I refer to him as YDF, young Dar's father. He's listed in the script. YDF, he turns around to YDF and says, "Father," and nothing else. And that's it.
Yeah, they just give each other a look. It's like, well, I was like, that dude about to die right there.
Definitely.
Yeah, so Dar goes out into the field, and he goes out there with you know, a group of young men to like plow the fields and whatnot. And he takes his dog with him. Dog like stands up on this hill and he starts barking, and everybody's like, "Oh, what the hell is the dog barking at?" Off in the horizon, you can kind of see like this cloud, which you can tell that like there's like something coming. And so Dar and his group run back to the village just in time that the Jun horde attack the village.
Right.
So again, this is like Conan, you know, barbarians come in, attack the village, kill everybody for no real good reason.
First off, young Dar's father goes and dramatically like grips the sword, which he just keeps leaning up next to the gate, I guess.
Just in case.
He pulls it out dramatically, draws like a line in the sand, like, come on, let's get it. Let's get it on.
He does do like this wavering.
He turns to a statue. And just gets trampled.
Mown down.
Yeah,
he does. Never even swung the sword once.
I don't think he did, you're right.
He just stood there.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. That bothered me.
Yeah. John, you have any thoughts on
Juns are moving fast. There's a lot to unpack in that whole little sequence. Not the least of which is like, what are they farming? Kind of looks like they're hacking at grass. Not a lot of actual grass. Farming.
It's like a lot of wheat.
It could only be some sort of grain.
Yeah. But, RIP YDF, like getting mowed down.
He just got, he did not do a damn thing.
Who, Dar?
The dad.
No, the dad.
YDF, yeah.
Yeah.
He gets points for being at point, but
the line in the sand was about the most heroic thing.
Yeah. He did save Beastmaster, I guess.
Earlier. From the witch. Yeah.
But yeah, whatever.
And we also do see, we get our first glimpse of the big bad, the Jun captain.
Yeah.
It looks like an extra from Road Warrior.
Yeah. That was a pretty badass outfit.
Yeah, man. The costume is cool.
Very memorable. He's got like these sort of bat wings like on his helmet. And, like in a silhouette, he looked awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So the Jun horde, they rush in. And again, they kill everybody. Why do these people always attack like
these
peaceful
poor
villages?
Farmers. They have nothing.
Like, you're going to take their wheat? You didn't even, I can see if like in this movie, they didn't even take anything. They just killed everybody. Like they didn't take their kids. They didn't take their women. They just came in and just killed everybody. So, Dar rushes in. He's trying to fight everybody. And I think he gets in a couple licks.
Yeah, he takes a guy or two out.
Yeah, and I think he gets into a fight with the. This sets up the end of the movie because he gets into a little bit of a fight with the Jun Horde leader,
the big bad guy,
right? But I forget what happens. Like he gets knocked out from behind.
Dar gets a lot of blunt force trauma to the head in this scene. And I will say, to the villagers' credit, at least a few of them got in some licks. It made them seem like not such big pushovers.
They did fight back, but they were overwhelmed
by the 24-30 Jun Horde horsemen that arrived in the village.
Well, I mean, five men with guns could take That's out right. 30 men with sticks. Yeah.
So Dar gets kind of knocked out, I guess, or hit from behind and blind and whatever. And the dog heroically like comes and drags him out of danger, even gets shot with an arrow and still comes back and drags
him out. How much does Dar weigh?
I would say like probably 180, 190.
Yeah, 180, because he's muscle. He's, so I would say like 180.
Yeah. And that dog pulled that guy like all out into the field.
That was you could tell when watching the movie that he was on like a dolly. Yeah,
absolutely.
Like it kind of rolls.
Yeah. Like the dog, like I didn't remember the dog grabbed his shirt and then like kind of dropped it, but he could still see him pulling him away.
And he wakes up sometime later, who knows, whatever. He comes back. Well, first, I guess he wakes up and he sort of mind melds with the eagle.
For like a split second, it's the weirdest thing.
He's seeing through the eagle's eyes, as he's laying there, as he's waking up or whatever.
It's like, was that eagle sent to him? Because there had to have been plenty of eagles from the time he was with the bear to the time that he was the man.
Yeah.
There have been plenty of eagles that have flown past that village. So why this eagle, you know?
That's true. I don't know why.
Yeah, it was almost like it was meant to be.
There's a moment when Dar gets a knock on the head and some person falls out of one of the stilled houses in that battle where you hear the chimes and that, Kevin, you want to do the eagle noise?
Oh man. It's just like, that's my all-time favorite sound effect. All-time favorite. That's my favorite sound effect, dude. It makes me laugh.
Really? Not his hawk call?
His call?
Yeah, but who amongst us has not practiced that hawk call? Seeing this
I can't do it.
But, yeah, like, when the dog got shot with the arrow.
Yeah, something. Yeah,
some
that's
moment,
what it was.
There was, like, a sound effect, and it just seemed like something happened. I thought maybe he was just feeling the dog's pain.
Yeah, that's. I think it was, like, some sort of empathetic reaction to the dog getting shot that sort of opened the floodgates of his ability to communicate with him.
That's a kind of a sad moment.
Yeah.
The dog, dog was a hero.
Yeah, the dog sacrificed himself to. And
no chance my dog would not try to drag me out of.
Oh, yeah. Grace would be like licking my face, like, get up, dog. Get up, dad.
But he bonds with the eagle, who he calls Sherak.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes and he finds that the Juns had like put all the villagers up on pikes.
Or
which
some
was like
of them,
super gross.
Some of them, and some of them are just like laying around in a.
Yeah,
village,
that's true. Yeah. But that was like gnarly.
Well, it's like putting heads on pikes.
Brutal, yeah. It's like just very, like for this movie, there's not a lot of blood in this movie.
Mm.
Like that was one of the more gruesome things.
There's a much more gruesome thing coming up.
So
this is where Dar starts his journey basically, because now he's got his hawk.
Well, he lays all the villagers to rest.
Yeah.
And there's like that poignant moment that almost got me choked up when he like lays the dead dog in his like father's arms.
Yeah. This is for this type of movie, that was tender moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it was kind of cool.
That one like got me just because as a dog owner.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally get you.
Well, dear listeners, that's all we've got time for this week. But please join us next time as we continue our breakdown of The Beastmaster.